Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it.
Watch out.
After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners do support the Peter B. Collins Show, and I am grateful to Jason Spitzer of San Jose, California, Raymond Welch of Sacramento, and Robert Mendez da Costa. I'm not sure where he's from, but he's a monthly subscriber. Thanks to each and every one of you for your help in keeping the Peter B. Collins Show going. And a little bit later, we're going to meet Mike Bonanno. He is one of the Yes Men, and these guys specialize in confronting corporate power using street theater and media gimmicks. Most recently, the Yes Men published a phony edition of the New York Post, and it was distributed on the day that the United Nations was convening and focusing on climate change. But first, we take you to Buenos Aires, Argentina, where Truth Out reporter Sam Ferguson joins us once again. He updated us about a month ago in podcast number 46 on the war crimes trial of General Rovere, and a verdict is in now. Sam, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thanks very much, Peter. It's great to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us, and I really enjoyed our chat before, and if people haven't heard it, I want them to go back to podcast 46, because you provided us with a lot of background information on what happened during the dirty war in Argentina, going back to the 1970s and 80s. And there's a lot of great information there that we won't recover today, but I do want to refer people to it, podcast number 46. So General Rovere was one of the top commanders, not at the very, very top, but part of the military brass. And he was accused in the disappearances of more than 80 individuals. Tell us how the final weeks of the trial fleshed out and what the ultimate verdict was that was returned last week.
So over the last 3 weeks, prosecutors and lawyers for victims in the case have summed up the over 100 and I think it's 116 victims in the case, all of the evidence against Rovere and four other officials who have been indicted. The defense attorneys also spent about 3 days summarizing the defenses in the case, and last Friday the court rendered a verdict in this case, finding Rovere guilty on over 80 cases of disappearances and four homicides committed in 1976 when he was the Army's commander in the city of Buenos Aires. He was sentenced to a life in prison, which unfortunately does not look like it will be very long, as the aging Rovere, who is 82 years old, looks somewhat frail these days.
And under Argentine law, he will serve it under home arrest anyway. Is that right?
That's the probable outcome. The sentence in the case, sentences here in Argentina are written, will be released December 10th. And the general rule here in Argentina is that people over 70 years old serve sentences under house arrest. Now, some courts here have given an interesting interpretation to that law in human rights cases against the dictatorship recently, sending older prisoners to regular prisons. But the court that was hearing this case is amongst the more conservative, legalistic tribunals, and most likely Rovere will spend his days under house arrest.
Mm-hmm. And as you report in your article at truthout.org, General Rovere took the, not the stand, but took the floor and offered a statement in his own defense that lasted as long as an hour.
That's correct. At 11 a.m., the court convened and first summoned Rovere to the witness stand. For over an hour, he gave a kind of wide-reaching, at sometimes convoluted defense of the military during the 1976 dictatorship, saying that the repressive campaign they fought against the quote-unquote subversives was justified to combat international Marxism, infiltration from Cuba, the Soviet Union, and that he hadn't violated anybody's human rights. Now, the court obviously did not find this convincing, but it's interesting to see military officials still to this day defend the tactics of the regime to the very last.
And you also detail here that of the four homicides of which he was convicted, two of those related to Uruguayan politicians. So that doesn't really fit in his excuse that he was fighting terrorism in his own nation.
That's correct. In the last several years, researchers have uncovered something known as Plan Condor, which was an international clandestine campaign amongst the Latin dictatorships of the 1970s to hunt down exiles living within the other's borders. So when the Uruguayan military intervened in 1973, hundreds of thousands of Uruguayans fled across the Rio de la Plata here to Argentina. And when the Argentine military intervened and threw the democratic government out in 1976, they began to cooperate with the Uruguayan regime, eventually hunting down hundreds of Uruguayans living here in Argentina, mostly in Buenos Aires. Now, two of those, Zelmar Michelini and Hector Gutierrez, were both prominent Uruguayan politicians. And in May of 1976, they turned up in a car with bullet holes in their heads stuffed into the trunk. They were found there with two other Uruguayans who had been members of the Tupamaro guerrilla organization in Uruguay and had fled. And Rovere was ultimately convicted of these four homicides.
And what was his motivation in taking out these Uruguayan politicians?
Well, it's interesting. Rovere himself wasn't convicted as the actual murderer, the man who pulled the trigger in this case. The prosecution brought a kind of command responsibility case against Rovere. So the actual officials involved in the case were not, the actual assassins involved in these homicides were not part of this case. Rovere was convicted as commander of the group who attacked these people. But it was generally the Latin dictatorships shared a certain repressive hostility towards the left. So they attacked many guerrilla organizations, but the repressive campaign reached far beyond guerrilla groups and went to dissident politicians who were forming exile committees abroad to challenge the military dictatorships in the international arena. They targeted union officials who had fled abroad, and it was part of a larger repressive apparatus amongst the Latin dictatorships.
Mm-hmm. And did anything surface that indicates how those communications took place and what kind of coordination there was between these dictatorships?
You know, that wasn't part of the case, but there is one clandestine center here in Buenos Aires known as the Club Atlético, which is the clandestine black site where most of the Uruguayans who were disappeared in Argentina were eventually held. Now, there were some high-level contacts between Uruguayan and Argentine officials who would fly prisoners across the Rio de la Plata from Argentina to Uruguay after they had been captured in one of the countries. And the communiques usually happened at the kind of colonel, lieutenant colonel, general level. Unfortunately, I don't know all the details of the program, but that's my understanding.
Interesting. Now, as this verdict was returned, there were two guilty verdicts against General Rovere and Bernardo Menendez, and then three individuals were acquitted, And this produced a very negative reaction from the activists who were there observing the courtroom action.
Yeah, so the first two sentences which Judge Guillermo Gordo read off were against Rovere and another man charged in the case, Bernardo Menendez, who was also sentenced to life in prison for one homicide and ordering five kidnappings. Now, as soon as Judge Gordo began to read the three other sentences in the case, which were three absolutions, a tense kind of murmur simmered up in the courtroom. And as soon as the judgment was done and the judges stood up to leave the courtroom, the spectators gallery absolutely erupted into a fury. People began banging the walls. They began shouting accomplices and genocidios, which means like genocidaires, at the judges themselves. They then went into a chant of murderer, murderer against the three defendants who had been absolved. And the activists who had gathered in the galleries were absolutely enraged by this verdict. Some of them used some words that perhaps we shouldn't say over the air.
Well, we're not on the air. We're on a podcast, so you can say them. Go right ahead, Sam.
Yeah, so one very active victim, his name is Carlos Lord Kipanitsi. He was held himself for over a year by the Navy and is one of the primary movers amongst the group known as the Association of X. Detained and disappeared people screamed son of a bitch at the judges and was shaking after the verdict, thinking that this was an absolute travesty of justice.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's very hard from here to second guess, but given that they did convict Rovere and Menendez, it suggests that the judges were not trying to fix things. Did you get a sense that they pulled punches to acquit these three individuals, or do you think that from what all, you know, everything that you can see, that it was a relatively fair process?
I mean, at this point, it's a little bit hard to tell. We're still waiting for the sentence to come out in the case in December, but these are three generally respected judges. The chief judge, Guillermo Gordo, has been on the bench for over 30 years and has a pretty good, if somewhat authoritarian, reputation based on conversations I've had with attorneys here in Buenos Aires and conversations I've had with the judge himself. It's hard to see what the motives are. It's possible that there's a little bit of politics going on here. You have to understand that Gordo's chambers are completely and absolutely clogged with human rights cases. They've devoted perhaps 95% of the last 3 years exclusively to these cases, and it will remain that way for perhaps 5, 6, 7 years to come. I mean, these cases are massive. They involve hundreds of witnesses, dozens of defendants, and they take 6 to 8 months to prosecute generally. So this could be a way for Gordo to symbolize to prosecutors and magistrate judges here that they need to be careful in selecting which cases they want to elevate to trial, as you need really solid evidence against these people to convict, that perhaps simply demonstrating that they were part of the army during a repressive time is not enough to convict them of the crimes that the army perpetrated.
Mm-hmm. So if we put up the Jumbotron, a total of 560 officials altogether have been indicted, 60 have been convicted, and a total of 6 have been found not guilty, including the 3 in last week's verdict. And you know, you're describing a kind of gridlock in the court system there. Do the judges have any ability to schedule the cases or to prioritize them in order to deal with the most egregious offenders? Or is it kind of like whatever comes up in the pipeline next, that's what they deal with?
Yeah, so far the process has been relatively chaotic. Whatever comes through the pipeline, that's the cases that end up in their laps, and those are the cases they go after. So you see this kind of schizophrenic prosecution of the military, that last year a lower-ranking official named Febres was prosecuted on 4 counts of kidnapping and torture. He was a lower-level official at the Argentine Naval Mechanics School, which is sometimes called the Auschwitz of Argentina. In fact, he was he was either murdered or committed suicide just before the sentencing. So we don't know the verdict in this case, but it took up months of the court's time when other cases were in the backlog against higher officials waiting to be prosecuted. Now, time has also taken its toll. In the Rovere case, which was just sentenced, there was another defendant that was supposed to be part of the case. His name is Guillermo Carlos Suarez Mason. He was one of the military's top officials, just one rank below the first de facto president, Jorge Videla. He is perhaps responsible for the death of 5,000 people. Now, he was originally indicted in this case in 2004, but he died under preventive detention in 2005. There's another official who was also indicted in this case. His name was Devoto, and he too died before the case reached trial. So time has had its impact on these cases. Just about 5 months ago, an appeals court here dispersed some of the cases. Every single case in the city of Buenos Aires had been in the hands of Gordo's court, and now they've sorted a few others into three of the six tribunals here in Buenos Aires. So it should speed up the process a little bit, but these cases will go on for years and years to come.
And what is the sentiment? You described the activists who are disappointed at the not guilty verdicts that were rendered, but on a broader sense, is the public fascinated by these trials, or is this ancient history and people have moved on and you know, the average Jose Sixpack, I don't know what the right term would be, but the average citizen, do they care or are they disengaged?
Well, yeah, well, there are two ways to answer that question. In 2003, when Congress passed a law annulling Argentina's amnesty laws, which gave the political cover to reopen many of these cases, the law pulled at about 70% approval rating. So in general, people are happy with the prosecution. Nobody is a fan of the military officials here in Argentina who are responsible for the deaths and kidnapping of between 9 and 30,000 people. That being said, there's a lot of politics in these cases. The ruling Kirchner government has put a lot of emphasis on these cases, and reopening the human rights trial is part of their political project. They've used the trials as a way to solidify an electoral majority. So as opposition to the Kirchner government grows, opposition to the trials has also grown. And you hear more people these days saying, what's in the past is in the past. Or alternatively, they say that the military shouldn't be prosecuted because the members of Argentina's leftist guerrilla organizations are not being prosecuted today either. It's kind of a mixed bag, but in general, I would have to say that people aren't really paying close attention to these cases besides the human rights activists who are pushing them. Very few news articles come out about the cases except for in Argentina's left-leaning Página 12. Mm-hmm. If you go to the trials, you don't see many journalists in the galleries and the day-to-day activity of the trials. They might show up for opening and closing arguments and the sentencing, but there's not a real close attention to these cases, as one might hope.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's take a sidebar here, because you recently traveled to Montevideo, Uruguay, and there is a similar struggle underway. There is a ballot measure or a referendum which was defeated that would have repealed the amnesty law, which has been in effect for some years now. And so in Uruguay, it seems that sentiments are a little different from what you're finding in Argentina.
Yeah, Uruguay is sometimes referred to as the Switzerland of the South because of its relative economic and political stability compared to other countries here in the region. Argentines are known for their kind of schizophrenic and ever-changing psychology, and Uruguayans are known to be kind of tranquil, low-key people. Now, granted, this is a gross, gross overgeneralization, but perhaps it helps describe the difference in the process in the two countries. So on Sunday, Uruguayans took to the polls in national elections. The ruling coalition of the Frente Amplio, or Wide Front Socialist Coalition, won the first round, but Uruguayans also voted whether or not to uphold a 1986 amnesty law that was passed in the wake of Uruguay's democratic transition. Now, the repression was slightly different in Uruguay than in Argentina. Far fewer people disappeared, and in fact, the overwhelming majority of Uruguayans who disappeared here in Argentina. But 200 people remain missing, and justice has never been done for these people. But on Sunday, voters, by a very, very narrow margin, decided not to repeal this country's amnesty law. The repeal effort only garnered 48% of the vote, so Uruguay's amnesty law will still be in place.
And the sentiments that you've captured in the quotes of Uruguayans that you talk to, they sound like some of the things we've been hearing out of the Obama administration here in the United States, that, oh, you know, we want to look forward and, you know, it's time to move on. And here is you also were able to talk with Gonzalo Aguirre Ramirez, a former senator and former vice president of Uruguay. And he said that if the amnesty law had been annulled, that it was very dangerous. And you quote him, "Imagine if you get divorced and then you remarry. Then the state annuls the marriage law and prosecutes you for bigamy. This is the path we're taking." Now, that's a fairly ludicrous analogy, but it probably is really meaningful to the former vice president.
That's right. Uruguayans have expressed various reasons for wishing to respect the amnesty. One is that Uruguayans, in fact, voted on a similar referendum in 1989, and it lost then. Others are worried that if they repeal this law, it'll threaten legal security in all sorts of areas. And given what's happened perhaps in Argentina and Venezuela and other more left-leaning countries, they look around and say, well, if it's prosecuting the military now, it might be nationalizing the banks tomorrow. And that's kind of a common sentiment amongst the more conservative sectors in Uruguay. Now, it's not clear, however, that the vote, which garnered 48%, is in fact a clear message in favor of the amnesty law, and this has to do with the mechanics of how Uruguayans vote. Activists for the campaign here, for the campaign in Uruguay, point out that when you go to the polls in Uruguay and you vote on a referendum, the only way to vote on the referendum is by putting a C or a yes ballot into an envelope. If you're against the law, you don't put a no ballot into the envelope. So no and an abstention have the exact same force. For a referendum to pass, 50% of the entire voting population has to vote for it. So the fact that this initiative garnered 48% of the vote probably means that more people in Uruguay supported repealing the amnesty law than were, in fact, affirmatively opposed to it, as you have to figure that some significant percentage of people simply did not vote on the referendum.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also quote Aguirre Ramirez as saying, well, this is just, the amnesty is just, because we also gave amnesty to the Tupamaros. And that seems a little bit off base to me as well, because what we're talking about here in terms of war crimes is official misconduct and violation of constitutional rights, perhaps international treaties. And criminal behavior or even terrorist behavior doesn't seem to fall into that same category, at least not to me.
That's true. International law, in fact, makes this distinction very clearly, that crimes against humanity are only perpetrated by state actors. That's the reason why Argentina is going after the military and not after the guerrilla organizations who were also violent in the 1970s, because there's a clear obligation to prosecute acts of state which go beyond international conventions such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights, and other similar treaties. So Uruguay, in fact, is probably violating international law by respecting this amnesty law. Now, that said, it's not clear that the actual vote on Sunday has much of a practical effect. And here I have to describe a little bit the mechanics of the way the amnesty law works.
Okay.
So it's a very strange law. If somebody brings a charge against an official from the dictatorship, the judiciary is forced to turn the files over to the executive, to the president, giving the president the opportunity to review the files and determine if the case is the type of case that was contemplated under Congress's original decision in 1986 to amnesty the military. Now, for 19 years, from 1986 to 2005, this functioned as a de facto amnesty, as every case that went to the president was determined to be contemplated by the amnesty, and no cases ever went forward. But in 2004, or 2005, excuse me, I'm forgetting the date for a moment, when Tabaré Vázquez of the leftist Frente Amplio coalition took office, the president finally began to determine that certain cases were beyond the scope of Uruguay's amnesty law, namely those cases involving the kidnapping and clandestine adoption of children and hiding their identity from their biological parents, and also crimes that were committed against Uruguayan exiles abroad and involved Uruguayan officials, such as crimes under the Plan Cóndor that we talked about earlier. So under this new vision of the amnesty law, cases have proceeded against many of Uruguay's top officials. In fact, just last week, the last dictator of Uruguay, Gregorio Alvarez, was sentenced to 25 years in prison, and the first de facto president has been indicted and is currently being held under preventive detention. So practically, it's not clear that because this initiative lost, there will be fewer officials indicted and charged and convicted who are members of Uruguay's last dictatorship, although it might reduce the number of cases that are ultimately brought against them. Now, the other thing that's happened
But Sam, that kind of relies on President Vasquez to remain in office, right? As long as he's there, you might see these selective prosecutions continue, but it's anybody's guess what happens when he leaves office.
That's true, and actually there is a one-term limit here in Uruguay, but it seems as though his successor from the Frente Amplio Party, José Mujica, will succeed him. There's currently a runoff election scheduled for this November, but it seems as though the governing coalition will remain. Now, what I was about to say is that 6 days before the election, the Uruguayan Supreme Court declared that this amnesty law, known as the Ley de Caducidad, was in fact unconstitutional because it violated Uruguay's vision of separation of powers, because it gives the president so much power within the prosecutorial and judiciary investigative process. It's unconstitutional because the president is infringing on the judiciary's powers. Now, Uruguay, because it's a civil law system, functions a little bit differently than the United States. This pronouncement doesn't mean that the law vanishes. Lower court judges are still free to apply the law and send the cases to the executive because this case has what's called moral force, but it doesn't have the force of precedent as it would in the United States. Now, that said, Supreme Court cases are generally followed, and you're likely to see a lot of cases in the coming weeks and months, especially now that the law was not repealed by the voters. You're likely to see a lot of cases against military officials being reopened in the courts.
Mm-hmm. And Sam, what else would you like to add about the situation in Uruguay? Because I want to go back to Argentina and tie some of these things together.
I mean, that's about all I would say. You know, it's interesting to see what's going to happen aside from this amnesty law and the runoff elections this November 29th. Mujica, who is a former Tupamaro guerrilla himself, is going to be squaring off against Luis Lacalle, who is a kind of free market conservative politician in Uruguay, he himself was once president. Mujica garnered about 48% of the vote. Lacalle got about 30%, but has formed a coalition now with Pedro Bordaberry of the right-wing Colorado Party. So the two have about equal support in a very polarized electorate, and we have to wait to see to find out what happens.
Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting to see the interconnections here, that Uruguayans were subjects of the dirty war in Argentina, and at the, you know, roughly the same time, each of these nations is wrestling with the ugly legacy, and trying to figure out, sort through the best way to deal with it. And once again, Sam, I draw parallels to our struggles for justice here in the United States. And I hope that we don't end up, as my teeth are falling out 30 years from now, seeing justice for the clear violations I feel that occurred during the Bush-Cheney administration. And it's very difficult to carry these cases 30 years after, when so many people have died, witnesses are gone, and evidence is destroyed or dispersed. In general, the public loses sight of the issues that produced either the conflict or the huge overreaction by government. So I think these are fascinating stories that hopefully will teach us in the United States that justice delayed is, in fact, justice denied, and that we really need to confront these issues for the cleansing value, and also simply to administer justice in a way that is fair to all parties.
Yeah, in my personal opinion, I'd have to say in the United States that it's really now or never. One of the reasons why you see these cases coming back up so much later, a generation later here in Latin America, is that the victims themselves are members of these political communities. The victims' relatives still live there, they still vote, they have friends, they have lives in these countries, and have kept this claim for justice alive for over a generation. Now, what's interesting in the United States is the victims, for better or for worse, don't really figure into this question of whether we should prosecute torture. It's really framed in terms of American exceptionalism. We have to prosecute torture because we're the United States and we don't do that type of thing. But I doubt that that kind of public claim can sustain itself for 30 years, that after 30 years, people are going to have moved on and they won't consider it such an affront to the, I don't know, dignity of the United States that we didn't prosecute these people 30 years ago. I mean, maybe the better comparison in the United States is actually prosecuting civil rights perpetrators during the 1950s and the 1960s to prosecute people a generation later, as I think has happened in Mississippi several mm-hmm. times, of people who hung or murdered civil rights workers during Jim Crow.
The other thing that I think is a little interesting here is that both Argentina and Uruguay did pass laws that impose these amnesties. And what we see here is that Congress is not confronting these issues, not exercising their oversight role, and they're permitting the Obama administration to just slide away from accountability and investigations into what I consider, again, to be clear, lawbreaking that occurred under Bush and Cheney. And if Obama really wants to look forward, not backward, then I would say go ahead and propose an amnesty law. Because otherwise, we are skirting the Constitution, we are undermining the rule of law and accountability for our public officials who took an oath to uphold and defend our Constitution. And I'm not willing to play loosey-goosey or just kind of look the other way and say, oh, you know, it's too much trouble, it'd pack the courts, it would, you know, distract Washington. None of those arguments wash with me, because fundamentally I believe in our Constitution and the rule of law. And if Obama wants to make an exception and not investigate and prosecute the alleged wrongdoing, in particular the torture regimes, and in particular the violation of the Fourth Amendment through the domestic wiretapping and surveillance programs, then I think that the system should be allowed to work, and investigations and trials should go forward.
You know, by way of analogy, here in Argentina, there is now wide social consensus that the dictatorship was bad. People generally have a horrible view of the military. Their budgets have been continually slashed since the 1980s. But this was by no means inevitable. In fact, after the dictatorship collapsed in 1983 here, there was a big debate that raged in Argentina whether the military should be prosecuted. And the presidential candidate who ultimately won on a platform of prosecuting the military and doing justice for what happened during Argentina's dictatorship. So Alfonsín was the candidate that won, running on a platform of prosecution. And society was not at all, there was no consensus on this issue. The consensus against the military was something that had to be built, and it was partly through prosecution and exposing through the kind of theatrics of a trial what happened during the dictatorship that Argentina now lives in a kind of broad consensus that what happened under the military dictatorship was horrendous. So it's possible that Obama has a lesson that he could learn from Argentina. I mean, he seems to be very scared of polarizing the electorate, as if it's not polarized at the moment.
Yeah.
But he could perhaps learn from Alfonsín that, you know, if you look into the future and you can see what might come of society after these prosecutions go forward, it's possible that if the evidence is damning enough against Rumsfeld or against John Yoo or against Cheney, that after the trial, people will have a very low opinion of these people and, in fact, will be substantively against torture, whether it's committed against alleged terrorists or domestic citizens.
And, Sam, in either Uruguay or Argentina, did the media play a role in galvanizing public opinion about, particularly in the case of Argentina, repealing the amnesty a couple of years ago?
Absolutely. So the media first played a crucial role in 1985 when the nine members of Argentina's ruling junta were put on trial. In fact, a newspaper devoted exclusively to the trial was put out once a week, known as the Juicio a las Juntas, which was one of the most successful publications in Argentina's history. People followed the trial religiously and were fascinated by what was happening. Now, in 2003, when the amnesty was repealed here in Argentina, it's not really clear how that happened. Argentina was in the midst of a very deep economic crisis. In 2001, they were forced to devalue the peso, and Argentines lost about three-quarters of their wealth almost overnight. This caused a political crisis. There were six presidents who went in and out of the Casa Rosada, which is Argentina's White House, within a few months. And Néstor Kirchner eventually won elections and became president. And now trying some way to unite the country to get everybody out of this political and economic crisis, he used the issue of human rights to solidify an electoral majority. So it wasn't exactly that the media galvanized the public against the amnesty law. It's that Néstor Kirchner recognized a kind of political opportunity to do this and pushed the amnesty law through Congress.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. What I'm hoping is that our media will see the significance of these issues. And so far, the corporate media in this country certainly has reported, but not in an active way and not in a manner where they're digging in order to prod government action. They seem content with a series of one-day stories based on the actions of provocative people like, oh, the National Lawyers Guild that has called for the disbarment of John Yoo and his firing from the University of California at Berkeley. Those stories get reported, but you don't see enterprise stories where somebody digs in and really evaluates the legal opinions that John Yoo and Jay Bybee wrote that really were the framework for our torture policies. I'd like to see that change, and we'll see if that happens. Well, Sam Ferguson, thank you very much. I always learn a lot talking with you, and I appreciate your detailed reporting from Buenos Aires today.
Thanks very much, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to try some great organic wine. Try the earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the pretty link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com. They've got a special introductory offer just for you. We mentioned that Mike Bonanno would be joining us from the Yes Men, but he got contacted by lawyers from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and isn't available right now. But somebody who's operating in the same orbit joins us now. K Kevin Zeis is the executive director of the Prosperity Agenda, and he's also on the board of directors of Velvet Revolution, their website, velvetrevolution.us, and they've launched a campaign regarding the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes. Kevin Zeis, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show today.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's good to talk with you, and you and the Mobilization for Healthcare for All have launched an effort to really bring attention to the crimes committed by insurance companies, the gouging of consumers, the promise of coverage that often is denied when people need it the most, and the bizarre and aggressive way that they have worked and spent huge amounts of lobbying dollars to block any meaningful health care reform here in the first year of the Obama administration. Tell us what you and your supporters are doing today.
Great. Thank you for asking. Well, mobilizeforhealthcare.org is the website, so people can get involved in this. We've had about, our goal is to have 1,000 people sign up to risk arrest protesting at the insurance companies. We've already had 78 arrests. We've had more than 100 people today risking arrest at sit-ins across the country. And what we're seeing is an effort on our part to highlight the denial of care. In most states, you don't know what the denial of care is. The insurance companies are not required to report it, and they keep it hidden. But in California, they are required to report it.
Mm-hmm.
And in California, 20% of the time that a doctor recommends care, the insurance companies refuse to pay for it. And some insurance companies are as high as 40% of the time. So
that's right. And that study was conducted by our friends of the California Nurses Association.
That's right. They're one of the great, excellent groups out there. I really love the California Nurses Association, and their work on health care is so important. We're very close allies with them. And so that shows this is a serious problem. What we found around the country is people are angry about it. People don't believe the insurance companies are the solution. They see the insurance companies as the problem. And our advocacy is for a Medicare for All system that takes the insurance companies out of the equation, removes that incredible waste of 31% of the cost of health care going to insurance companies, their executives, and the bureaucracy they create.
Mm-hmm.
1 out of 3 health care dollars is wasted on that rather than being spent on health care. So it's not surprising that all this effort that the Congress is going through, they're unable to cover everybody.
Yeah.
And this issue is not going away. You know, the congressional bills in 10 years, 20 million will be without insurance at best guess. And in 10 years, there'll be 100% increase in the cost of health insurance premiums. Plus, you'll have all out-of-pocket expenses going up. It's not controlling costs. It's not covering everyone. So this issue is not going away. And this national mobilization has energized thousands of people to do the right thing and do what needs to be done as a Civil Rights Act, to stand up to these insurance companies and say, no more denials of care, no more undermining our democracy.
And Kevin, what you are trying to draw attention to is the true nature of what I call the death squads. They're not just death panels, but death squads who are at the insurance companies now, and they are motivated by one factor in denying people's care, and that is to fatten the bottom line, to profit from taking people's premium money. And then when they actually need to use their insurance coverage, you say, nah, pre-existing condition, sometimes it's for cavalier reasons.
You're too old, it's experimental, whatever. They have hundreds of reasons why, and you're right, it is a squad. They hire people whose job it is to deny care.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they do, and it's profits over people. And their profits have gone up from $2.4 billion in 2000 to $12.7 billion in 2007. And during that time period, 45,000 Americans were dying every year for lack of health care. Compare that to murders. We have 17,000 murders in the United States per year. We have 45,000 deaths because insurance companies are putting profits before people. And this Congress wants us to have working people give hundreds of billions of dollars to these criminals. It's obscene. But it's pay-to-play politics at its worst. The only way to respond to pay-to-play politics, this corporate power problem we have, is for people to get organized and say no. We have to stand up so we don't get stepped on. And so that's what MobilizeForHealthcare.org is trying to do. Organize people in a way that they stand up and say, no more of this nonsense. We're taking control of the situation. We're not going to let Congress say that 20 million people without health care insurance is reform. We're not going to say that 100% increase in cost of premiums is reform. We're not going to say that no way to challenge a denial of care in court is reformed. That's all unacceptable. And so we're going to stand up and say no to that. And that's what this mobilizeforhealthcare.org is about, is challenging the corporate power of the insurance industry that unfortunately has too much power in Congress.
Well, and Kevin, you know, I'm hopeful. We're seeing some movement. Harry Reid has embraced a public option with some caveats. He'll allow states to opt out of it, and it appears that if there is some sort of public option, it'll actually be managed by a for-profit insurance company. So my expectations could not be lower at this point.
That's right.
But I have to say that it pains me to see this effort to preserve a role for the for-profit insurance companies in our healthcare delivery system, at the same time that the message point and the bill to withdraw the antitrust exemption for the healthcare industry, that I'm certainly not opposed to that, but the same people who are willing to vote for that are not willing to acknowledge that these leeches are not necessary in our healthcare delivery system, and in fact, they are a major driver in the annual cost increases. And why is it that we can't really complete the thought, complete the sentence, and say they have no place in this process whatsoever? They are takers, and they're not giving a thing.
You're singing my song, and I'll just, the way to look at this, I think, is to ask the very simple question: what service does the insurance industry provide that we need? They're just in the way. They cost 31%. Hospitals, because of the bureaucracy created by the insurance industry, often have one billing agent deal with the insurance industry per bed. They have more billing agents than they have nurses in hospitals. Doctors spend 3.5 weeks a year themselves filling out insurance paperwork, and 20% of their overhead dealing with the insurance industry. Consumers, we're constantly on the phone dealing with, are we covered? How do we get this medicine? And it's a constant fight. Businesses, constantly with bureaucracy. So everybody's affected by this, and it's driving up the costs and making it impossible for governments to have a balanced budget, because it drives up the cost of health care for governments as well. So they are a big detriment. The only thing I would change in what you said was, it's not just the for-profit insurance industry. It's the private insurance industry, because tomorrow we're demonstrating in Baltimore at a not-for-profit insurance, Care First, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and is a not-for-profit here. They have $1.3 billion in reserve, while we have 1,000 people a year dying for lack of health care in Maryland. They have a CEO that makes multi-million dollars a year in salary. They hide it, so we don't know the exact figure, but the last CEO, they tried to give him a golden parachute of $36 million severance. It got knocked down to 18, and finally got knocked down to 9 by regulators. A $9 million severance he got. They have office space in Class A, a building that's owned by a bank. It's a big business building. This is not a way that not-for-profit should operate. And so even the not-for-profit insurance companies are a problem, because they also put their profits, their money, the amount they can put in reserve, the amount they can pay themselves ahead of the people's basic necessity for health care. So you're right. What's their role? Let's get them out of the picture and remove them from. And the problem I see in this bill, one of the problems I see in this bill, giving hundreds of billions of dollars by forcing people to buy overpriced insurance, it's going to lead to consistent and ongoing corruption of government. It's going to mean these corruptors of government are going to have more money to pay to play politics, to put into campaign coffers, to pay lobbyists, to hire spouses onto their boards, spouses of members of Congress on their boards. The corruption is going to continue to get worse and worse and worse until we stand up to it. And that's what we have to face up to, is this corruption of government is making it impossible to solve any of the critical problems the country is facing, and health care is certainly one of the biggest ones.
Now, Kevin, one of the motivations that's been identified here is that Rahm Emanuel, the White House chief of staff, is determined to get some sort of a bill that they can call health care reform, but he doesn't want it to be real reform, because he does want what you just described. He wants those big campaign contributions in time for next year's midterm elections, and he's not opposed to spouses of members of Congress serving on the boards of for-profit medical care companies or the private insurance companies. And so how do we get the White House to show real leadership for the interests of the American people? Because I'm very frustrated that even at this late date, President Obama has not laid out his markers of what is and is not acceptable to him in a final bill. And what that tells me is that he's not committed even to this watered-down and fuzzy public option. He simply wants a bill that he can say, yeah, see, I delivered health care reform.
I think that's exactly right, and I think that they're making a mistake. They're learning. It's like generals fighting the last war. They are learning from the Clinton experience. They think they've learned a lesson that if you fail to pass health care, you lose elections. What they're not learning is if you pass lousy health care, you're going to lose elections even worse. People, are as they learn more about this bill, are going to like it less and less. I've already mentioned that people are going to be forced to buy overpriced insurance. There are no cost controls. There's going to be a 100% increase in the cost of insurance over the next decade. That's not going to make people happy. There's no way for you to appeal to a court when the insurance company denies you health care that you've been paying for. There's no appeal process at all to go to court and have an independent review of that. There's going to be prejudice against people who are middle-aged and older, who are under Medicare age, but you know, out of the 20s when they start to get health problems. There are going to be much more expensive policies for those people. There's going to be wellness clauses where people can be charged more if they're overweight, which is a big problem in the United States, overweight people, because of the lousy food supply and the lack of exercise and other issues, especially a big problem among people in poverty where they have, you know, Detroit, there's not even a supermarket in the whole city of Detroit. They can't buy healthy food, so you have a lot of overweight tied to poverty there. So on all these issues, when people learn more about this in Bill Dez, they're going to see that the insurance is not affordable, that they're being forced to buy insurance that with the amount of money the government's giving is not going to be affordable. People can be spending, you know, over 10% of their income on insurance, and especially for working people in the lower level middle class. That's the largest source of poverty in the United States, is working people. They can't put enough food on the table, and so for them to be forced to buy insurance is obscene. They can't afford the food. So I think President Obama said it during his campaign that what we have to do, what we have to do, is hold him accountable. He said, hold me accountable. Well, I want the President Obama of 2005, who said that when the Democrats win back the presidency, the House, and the Senate, then we'll have single-payer health care. Let's hold them to that standard. And that's what this mobilization for health care is about. So mobilizeforhealthcare.org. Get involved and sign up. We have mobilizations going on in 19 cities between now and Tuesday. This is a nationwide campaign. We've done 11 mobilizations already before this. This is a campaign that's going to be ongoing and not going to stop just because Congress passes a bill that does not solve the problem.
One of my heroes in this battle, Kevin, is Dr. Margaret Flowers. We had a chance to talk to her a few weeks ago when she was on the road with the Mad as Hell Doctors.
Yep.
And she has been arrested. She was arrested at the Baucus Senate hearings. Oh, you were arrested too?
Yeah, I was one of the Baucus 8, yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you because you were speaking for me that day. And tell me what Margaret Flowers is doing right now, and is she going to get arrested in some of these protests that are underway this week?
Margaret and I are about as close political allies as you can have. We work very closely together, and we both live in the Baltimore area. We both live in Maryland, and we were two of the Baucus 8. Ended up being Baucus 13 after the second round of people protested. And we're working together on this challenge that we're going to be doing tomorrow in Care First in Maryland. And she, along with another doctor, a nurse, an 81-year-old man, and some students and other people, are going to risk arrest at this Care First sit-in. They will put themselves up to risk arrest because, well, from Margaret's perspective, you know, her rationale is that she just thinks that 45,000 deaths a year is not something we can remain silent about. To remain silent, she says, is to be complicit. And I think that's exactly how it is. We, as Americans, know that this system's corrupt. We know it's killing people. We know it places the United States, the richest country on earth, 37th in health care. And to remain silent is to be complicit. So it's our duty as Americans to hold the president accountable to his 2005 promise of single payer for all once the Democrats get control of the legislature and the executive branch. They have that now. That's what they should be doing, and they're not. And it's time for us to hold him accountable and stand up for those 45,000 people who die every year and for future generations of Americans who, if we don't solve this problem, we're going to have an economy that crumbles, because this is the driving force of debt and deficit for state and federal government. This is the health care is the driving force. If you get control of health care costs, you can get control of the budget. But if you don't get control of health care costs, you can't.
Now, Kevin, we know that the Republicans, including Olympia Snowe, will not be there to support this bill. And this empty effort for bipartisanship is something that's troubled me as I've seen the Democrats right up to the president negotiating with themselves, saying, hey, if I give this away, will you support it? And it boils down now to three L's in the United States Senate: Landrieu, Lincoln, and Lieberman. And I got to throw Ben Nelson in there, too, but his name doesn't start with L. What kind of strategy do you suggest for dealing with these recalcitrants? It does appear that Lincoln is now on the fence and that the threats from Fire Dog Lake on up the line to Act Blue are being heard by Senator Lincoln in Arkansas. But Landrieu is unapologetic, and she is up for re-election in the coming year. And Lieberman is in a very safe zone right now because he's got another 4 years to run on his term.
You know, I think, frankly, it's not going to work. I think the president, if he really is going to lead, he should say, look, we have tried the preserving the present system, the multi-payer system where insurance is tied to employment, and it doesn't work. We can't pay for it. We can't cover everybody. We can't control costs. It doesn't solve the basic problems of the health insurance denials. In fact, you know, I was talking to Donna Smith of the California Nurses Association, and she was featured as one of the patients in Sicko, Michael
sure.
Moore's movie.
I remember
she
her well, yeah.
Yeah, it was a powerful movie. She talked to all the Sicko patients who were featured. Every single one of those patients would have the same result after this bill is passed as before it. It does not solve the problems. I think President Obama, to show real leadership, should say, this is not working. We've tried this path. We've tried to satisfy the insurance industry. We've tried to satisfy the Republicans. It's not going to work. I knew all along that single payer was the most effective way to cover everyone. It was the most effective way to control costs. And we're going to advocate for a real national health care system and make it the election issue of 2010. We're going to educate the public throughout the year. We're going to campaign on this issue. This is the issue that all Americans are going to be hearing about and learning about. And we're going to make sure that candidates who support it get our support, and those who oppose it, we're going to defeat.
Now, Kevin, I love what you're saying, but I have to pinch myself. Is this a daydream?
I don't think that's what should happen. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I've been very disappointed on President Obama on almost everything. I can think of a couple things I like, but on, you know, on climate change, he's approving mountaintop removal. He's approving the idea of the EPA losing control of regulating coal plants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on a military budget, we have a bigger military budget rather than the smaller military budget. On wars, he wants to expand. He's expanded the war to Pakistan. I can go on. The list is endless of my disappointments. I do have some things I agree with him on, so it's not complete.
Don't forget the constitutional issues. That's where I'm really troubled on the Fourth Amendment.
I filed complaints against the Bush torture lawyers, including two who Obama kept on the federal government payroll. So, you know, I filed complaints to have them disbarred for their you know, support of torture, which I see as a war crime. How can you keep a law license if you're using your law license to, you know, cover up for war crimes?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but I'm getting off the topic. I mean, on this issue, it's pretty obvious now. We have tried to solve the problem by preserving the status quo, the insurance industry, and it doesn't work. We failed to cover everybody. We failed to control costs. We failed to deal with denials. People are too powerless in this system. We need to move toward a single-payer national health care system. We need a president who's going to lead that. But he's not going to do that unless we demand it, and that's our job. So as much as I can criticize President Obama, I can criticize the American people more for not getting – this is an immense opportunity we have right now. And if we don't stand up now and get organized and take action, we're missing a tremendous, maybe an historic opportunity to really move the country in a sensible direction. I don't call it progressive or left or, you know, or socialist. It's a pragmatic direction to solve basic problems the country is facing, and health care is number one problem that's not being solved.
Kevin Zeese with us. Again, the website mobilizeforhealthcare.org. Go check it out and take action as your conscience permits and dictates. Kevin, I also want to talk to you about another front that has been opened up, and I think this is a very important struggle to expose and hopefully rein in the role of the United States Chamber of Commerce in our federal government and in Washington in general. And their efforts occur on many fronts. One is that they are shilling for oil and gas and resource extractors to do everything possible to block any meaningful climate change legislation or policies. One of the other areas that they have been very successful in over the last 15 years is packing the courts, particularly at the state level, where many Supreme Court justices are directly elected by the people. And all across the country, they have been supporting and helping fund pro-corporate candidates for state Supreme Court jobs. And the effect is very clear in the rulings from those benches. They're getting a real bang for their buck, a heavy return on their investment. And Velvet Revolution and other groups have aligned to expose the Chamber of Commerce and to try to get its constituent members to understand the evil work that they're doing. And we're seeing some benefits. Recently, Apple Computer and other companies resigned from, even Pacific Gas and Electric, our utility here in San Francisco, resigned their membership in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Tell us a little bit about this effort and how you see it proceeding.
Well, that is an important effort, and you've laid it out very well. This is an example, by the way, of one area where I agree with President Obama. He has also taken on the Chamber of Commerce, and I think that's a very wise move. If you're facing a gang of bullies, you go after the leader of the bullies, and right now the Chamber of Commerce is that leader of the corporate bullies. And so going after the Chamber of Commerce and bloodying their nose and weakening them, I think, is a smart move by President Obama, and I'm glad to be supporting his effort on that front. My organization, ProsperityAgenda.us, deals with all the issues you talked about: climate change, healthcare, regulation of banks, regulation of businesses, tort reform, all those issues ProsperityAgenda.us deals with, and we constantly find the Chamber of Commerce on the wrong side of those issues fighting our efforts at reform. So that's one reason why I've joined the Velvet Revolution campaign, the VelvetRevolution.us campaign to stop the Chamber. I'm on the board of Velvet Revolution. And I see this proceeding actually pretty aggressively. I think that you're really, I'm glad you pointed out the state judicial issue, because that is critical. You know, we do have three equal branches of government, and they really are all, each one of them is powerful. The executive branch, which is the president and the governors, the legislative branches, and the judicial branch. And what happened was in the mid-1990s, you started to see legislation on tort reform, and some of the state courts started saying, no, you can't do that, it's unconstitutional, taking away the rights of citizens to sue when they're damaged. And the Chamber of Commerce realized that they had to get control of the courts. And so what they started to do was pretty nefarious. They started to spend, especially in 2000 and beyond, tens of millions of dollars a year on these kinds of races for Attorney General and Supreme Court justices mm-hmm. around the country. Now, these Supreme Court races don't usually have a lot of money in them. I mean, they're not like high-profile races. There's not a lot of media attention. And so when someone spends $1 million in a campaign like that, that dwarfs the campaigns.
In Wisconsin, they took out the only African-American justice the Supreme Court by using lies and smear tactics
exactly.
that were driven by very expensive television advertising campaigns.
And they hide that they're behind it. Like, they set up a Citizens for Strong Ohio and to try to pack the court in Ohio. And they refuse to tell who the funders are. It took 5 years of litigation and a judge that said, I'm going to fine you $25,000 a day until you tell us who the funders are in order for those names to be released. It wasn't Citizens for Ohio. It turned out to be the insurance companies. It turned out to be the oil and gas companies. It turned out to be the developers, the sprawl developers. It turned out to be all the corporations that are doing so much damage to our country and have so much power. And, of course, they're not going to call themselves Corporations for a Strong Economy. They call themselves Citizens for a Strong Economy because that sounds better. And they do that all over the country. They create these front groups, and they hide the campaign donations. They don't report them on their federal taxes properly. So what we're calling for is an investigation. We want to see investigations in the House and the Senate, hearings held by John Conyers and Henry Waxman, looking at the Chamber of Commerce's role in these kinds of campaigns around the country and in the issues in the United States and at the federal level. And we also want Eric Holder to come in and be told about these problems and ask him to investigate.
But wasn't
the Department of Justice should be investigating this. This is much a bigger problem than Acorn, I'll tell you that.
But wasn't Eric Holder at I think he was at Latham and Watkins, and wasn't one of the major clients of that law firm, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce?
Of course. I mean, I think if you look at a lot of Obama's appointments, this is a problem. But once again, it comes down to people being organized. If we want to complain about Obama, we better do something in response to it. And we need to hold him accountable. He said he was going to change the ways of Washington. He said he was going to change the lobbying influence of lobbyists. And
well, he sure has. Lobbying's at an all-time high.
I mean, so, that's, you know, the real... It's our job as citizens to say, no, President, that's not what you said, and we're going to hold you accountable. As I said, now, he is right on this question of the Chamber of Commerce, and I'm really pleased to see him taking the Chamber on. Rather than talking to the Chamber, he's talking directly to corporations, CEOs, rather than lobbyists, and I think that is much better way to do business than it is to talk to these lobbyist groups like the Chamber of Commerce.
Well, the lobbying is their private sector stimulus package for the U.S. economy. That's about all that they have, the skins that they have in the game.
And once again, if some people get involved, on velvetrevolution.us site, we have the email addresses of the board members of the Chamber of Commerce. You can do a click and send letter to write them. Tell them, but we want to tell them basically is, fire Tom Donahue, their chief executive, who really has made them into a partisan Republican organization, and democratize the way that you handle your decisions on issues, because the reason why Apple and other companies are leaving is because they're left out of the process. They're told, here's what we're going to be in favor of climate. We think climate change is good for the United States. Mm-hmm. You know, and so they're angry about that, and so that's why they're dropping out. So democratize the process, and finally become a trade association, not a political action committee. And you make those kind of changes of a new leadership, democratize, and trade association, remake the Chamber of Commerce into what it used to be, a business trade association on how to do good business practices, not a group that tries to pack the courts, elect Republicans, stand in the way of any kind of positive change. Because, you know, businesses benefit from a clean, sustainable economy. The new economy of the future is going to be clean businesses. It's going to be efficient housing, efficient cars, efficient transit. That's the future business. So the Chamber of Commerce is not even advocating for what's good for business anymore. They're advocating what's good for the status quo polluters. And that's the mistake. So The Chamber of Commerce needs to be remade. So I urge you to go to velvetrevolution.us, get onto the Chamber of Commerce project, and click and send to the Chamber and their board, and also to your members of Congress urging an investigation. We can make this change happen if we get organized. That's what it's all about. It's corporate power versus people power. The people can really respond if we get organized and do it together.
And Kevin Zeist, let me just add a couple of other factors here related to the Chamber of Commerce and get your comments. One, their effort to pack the court with pro-corporate judges came out of their disappointment at the Master Tobacco Settlement.
That's right.
That cost corporate America a lot of money, and many other industries said, wow, if they can do that to tobacco, they could do it to us.
Yep.
Secondly, a lot of that effort to pack these courts was originally coordinated by one Karl Rove, who made his mark electing justices, including one of the great legal minds of the last several centuries, Alberto Gonzalez, to the Texas Supreme Court.
That's right.
And finally, I would add that this is all tied up in the Don Siegelman case. These factors, the tobacco settlement, the desire to pack courts, the desire to get rid of people like Siegelman who were inconvenient to these efforts, it's all tied up in the same ball. And if the Obama administration would give a fair new trial to Don Siegelman, if they would fire the U.S. attorneys, the Republican holdovers who are still burrowed in the Justice Department, there are 94 positions across the country, and most of those are still held by Bush appointees. There is no excuse for that. And finally, on Siegelman's behalf, he deserves not only a new trial, but a full investigation of the bad faith, fraudulent efforts, failure to recuse on the part of the judge in the matter. All of those amount to miscarriages of justice that should be fully exposed, and the wrongdoers should be held accountable.
No, I think that you laid it out pretty well. In fact, I'd say that the Bush-Karl Rove team worked very tightly with Tom Donahue of the Chamber of Commerce on all these issues. And, for example, on the tobacco settlement, the Chamber of Commerce was critical to getting Bush elected. raising lots of money for him and becoming a fundraising arm of the Bush campaign. And when President Bush came in, he did what was promised, essentially, and the tobacco settlement that Clinton had been working on became suddenly a pennies on the dollar settlement under the Bush administration, and tobacco industry was saved literally billions of dollars. It was a very wise investment by the tobacco companies to help elect George Bush. And similarly on the judge issue, on the judges around the country issue, you're right, Karl Rove is smart enough to see that that equal branch of government, the judicial system, is critically important to the direction of the government, and it's critically important to corporate power. And I have to say that one thing I'm always disappointed with when I see a Supreme Court nominee and how the Democrats approach it is they never pursue the question of the relationship of that nominee to corporate power. Did they work for law firms that protected corporations? Did they challenge corporations? Were they consumer advocacy? You look at the nominees that, that have come up in recent years, including the one that President Obama made, they come from the corporate power elite. And we need to start to recognize that that is a critical issue to break. And if there's one problem that underlies all of the issues that are of concern in the United States, whether it's climate change, clean energy, whether it's controlling the military budget, whether it's health care, whether it's banking regulation, financial regulation, business regulation, protecting the environment, on all these issues, it comes down to corporate power.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, President Obama has not shown so well on that yet. A lot of his appointees have been coming from that same background. I hope that this focus on the Chamber of Commerce is essentially focusing on the lead bully, and that he'll be sending a signal, and that may be a first step toward really starting to challenge corporate power, because that's where change begins.
Yeah.
And that's why I constantly harp on people getting organized, because that is the only antidote to corporate power is people power, and we do have the power if we want it. We do have the power if we want it. We can't believe the corporate media tells us we're powerless. We do have the power if we want it. We just have to get organized and take it. We have to stand up so we can't be stepped on. And if we do that, we can really see some paradigm shifts on climate change, on military budget, on empire and wars, on health care, on all these issues. That's what's so distressing about all these issues. The solutions are right before us. We know what the solutions are. If you look at prosperityagenda.us, we lay out a paradigm shift on the economy that democratizes the economy the way that Michael Moore talks about in his current movie without going into a lot of detail. We go into detail on it. How to democratize the economy so we get control of the Federal Reserve, so we get control of our workplace, so that we get control of our health care, our education, we ensure well-paying jobs. On so many issues, the answers are right before us. And the reason we're not grasping them, the reason why the status quo is winning in Washington, while we're seeing the polluters winning, while we're seeing the insurance industry is winning, while we're seeing the military-industrial complex winning, and the banking industry winning, is because the people are not organized. And we're starting to see it, by the way. People are getting organized. We've been with the MobilizeForHealthcare.org project and with the VelvetRevolution.us project dealing with the Chamber of Commerce. We have seen people coming forward. People want to find ways to do this. And so I think it's part of our job, you know, to provide people with avenues to get active and get involved, because I think people see this and want to do it. They just don't know where to go. And so that's what we're trying to do through these various projects, is provide people's ways to get involved, get informed, get active, and be effective. I think we can do that.
And, Kevin, one of the interesting episodes in this struggle against the Chamber of Commerce occurred about a week ago, when one of the people aligned with the Yes Men held a phony news conference at the National Press Club in Washington. It was Jude who was the front man there.
Right.
And as I mentioned earlier in the podcast here, Mike Bonanno, one of the founders of the Yes Men, had been scheduled to join us for this program. He's been diverted into the legal zone because the Chamber of Commerce has slapped a lawsuit on the Yes Men for Jude's news conference last week. Now, if you've seen the video, and it's viral, 18 people sent it to me on Facebook in the past week, and I'm delighted to see that. What they did was hold one of these news conferences where they announced what they thought the Chamber of Commerce should be doing. And there was an actual Chamber of Commerce flack who showed up and was there in the back of the room trying to herd the press in his direction. So as political theater, I think it was very effective. And I think that, again, virally distributed, it alerted a lot of people who maybe don't listen to a program like this, don't watch the news, and aren't really focused on the Chamber of Commerce. It might have given them a first look at what this picture really is. What's your reaction to the work of the Yes Men, Kevin?
Well, I think the Yes Men are brilliant. That's just the most recent theatrical performance that they've pulled off so effectively. And they've done those for years, and it amazes me they keep pulling them off. And the Chamber of Commerce is acting like it is. You know, it's a bully. And so it's bullying back by using the courts that they stack to try to get the Yes Men. But I think the Yes Men are going to turn that on its head and find a way to use that to their advantage. I don't think they'll be cowed by it. The Yes Men, by the way, are part of our VelvetRevolution.us campaign against the Chamber of Commerce, so we're allied with them. And, just like the Chamber of Commerce is on the wrong side of every issue that we work on, the Prosperity Agenda, I find the Yes Men to be on the right side of every issue that we're working on at ProsperityAgenda.us. So they're doing great work, and they're really good allies. They're a fantastic, fake New York Post.
Yep.
That came out great. They did a fantastic
thing. Right, during UN Week in New York.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. A few years ago, they did a really great stunt with Bo Powell and Dow, and they put out a press release saying that the company was going to pay the damages caused by the Bo Powell chemical spill, and it dropped the stock of the corporation rapidly.
Yeah,
but and, it got the message across.
I want to direct listeners to podcast number 39. That was a discussion with Larry Bogad, who is a professor of political theater at the University of California, Davis. He's in cahoots with the Yes Men, helped them put together that faux edition of the New York Post. And at the time we were speaking with him, he was in Pittsburgh for the G29 summit, or how many ever G's we've got there now. So it's a very interesting look. Also, the feature film about the Yes Men is debuting in the Bay Area this weekend at the Roxy and Kabuki Theaters in San Francisco, the Oaks in Berkeley, and the Rafael Theater in downtown San Rafael. I've seen it, and it's amusing, which is a good thing, but it's also very powerful to see how they use the corporate media to expose both corporate malfeasance and the complicity of the corporate media.
You know, I think that the Yes Men are just one example of many of why I'm optimistic. I think that people are better informed than the corporate elites recognize. I think that the people are starting to recognize that we have power, that we actually can influence the outcome of things. We're more networked than people realize. We are more organized, and I think we just have to start to direct our energy. And I think we're starting to do that. I think the one thing about Obama that is good is that he is raising the right issues. He's raising the issues of health care, the issue of climate change, the military budget, banking regulation. He's not always putting forward the right answers because there's still too much corporate power that he has to fight. And it could be his own fault, or it could be the reality of the situation. But the reality of it is that it's our job to change that reality. I think we have the power to do it, and we need to recognize that we're doing a lot of it already. And if we can bring it together and continue to be more effective at it, we really can change these things around. We could be in store for a very historic moment where the change and hope that Obama unleashed creates more change than he planned.
Kevin, thank you for your isms, your optimism, your activism, and your progressivism.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your show. I'm glad to have a chance to get our message out and get people active.
MobilizeForHealthcare.org and also ProsperityAgenda.org, and go to VelvetRevolution.us and support the effort to stop the chamber. Kevin, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your comments are welcome. Drop me an email, fullofit@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.